okay, we're here with Dr. Bill D'Antonio, and this is our second part two of an interview with him on his journey in his life as a prominent Catholic sociologist. Bill, it's yours.
Well, okay, Gene, the first item on my list when I talk about coming to Notre Dame is that I found it that I wanted to be seen as a sociologist who was Catholic rather than a Catholic sociologist. At the time, there was this real labeling of people in sociology and psychology in particular. I don't know if it was true in, as true in history or something, that they wanted to know if you were a Catholic sociologist, which seemed to imply that you were, your sociology was built on your Catholicism and narrowly focused on that, or whether you're a sociologist who was Catholic, which is how I thought of myself, because my interest was in the broad field of sociology, in particular politics and ethnicity, working on the Mexican border, rather than on the sociology of religion. And I didn't think of myself as a sociologist of religion at all when I arrived at Notre Dame. There's a sort of a play, religion and sociology, or sociology and religion, comma, and the sociology of religion, Reflections, 1959 to 1971. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how those two interacted that constitutes the way I've been trying to look back on these years, because there was an interaction. The first thing that I'm reminded of was that when Julian Zamora and I arrived at the same time at Notre Dame, he as an associate professor and I as an assistant professor, the department chair, John Kane, let us know that if we went to the annual meetings of the American Catholic Sociological Society, which were held in conjunction with the meetings of the American Sociological Association, he would pay our hotel and transportation costs. But if we only went to the ASA meeting, then we'd be on our own.
Oh, wow.
So we joined the American Catholic Sociological Society so that we could enjoy the benefits of having our expenses covered. But very early on, and I remember we did attend the first meeting, happened to be in Chicago at some fancy hotel that since closed the Renaissance. I can't remember the name of it. But we went to Chicago, and we did go to the American Catholic Sociological Society meeting. And we found really two divisions. The old-timers who felt that the ASA, the American Sociological Association, was discriminatory against them. They hadn't gotten their articles published or whatever that caused them to found this American Catholic Sociological Society. And then young people like ourselves who felt that what was really important was sociology and not an American Catholic sociology. And so there was already a division there, and it grew in time so that I have to look up to see exactly when the date was, but at some point in time, those of us of the younger generation moved to change the name to the Association for the Sociology of Religion so that the focus was on the study of religion and not on the fact that we were Catholic. And that opened up the association to people who were not Catholic or not religious at all, necessarily, but who were interested in the study of religion. So that was the first encounter with the challenge of being American and being a sociologist and being Catholic. During the years when it was the early years, I don't recall that I ever gave a paper on religion. I managed to give a paper on politics and ethnicity on the Mexican border, which seemed to satisfy everybody, and even had Seymour Martin Lipset as a discussant one year on our paper. So we were working within a broader context than the association when we first joined. And then by the time they became the Association for the Sociology of Religion, I was beginning to turn my attention to the sociology of religion. But religion and being a sociologist came into interaction in several ways very quickly at Notre Dame. One was, if you think about it, the beginning of the movement of the Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that movement north, and I found myself early on somewhat shocked at the degree to which there was open prejudice against blacks in South Bend. And so I wrote, and even among students, and I ended up writing a paper called The Race Myth and the Christian Conscience. And the Notre Dame magazine published it, and it made a broad distribution. The funny thing about this is my father, who had his own problems with racial issues, as you might imagine from early Italian generations, where they were struggling up the ladder and felt pressure from the blacks right behind them, calls me up and he says, can you send me 20 copies of your article? And I said, well, I thought you were not happy with the article. It doesn't matter, he said. This friend of mine is a Notre Dame graduate, and he said he wanted some copies. And blood is thicker than water. He said, so send me the copies. And by the time somebody wants my son's articles, I'll send them. So I thought that was kind of a funny comment on that. So that, but I didn't see myself as a sociologist of religion there. I saw myself as a Catholic who was looking at an issue, an important for me ethical issue, and writing about it. I mean, I pulled data out that I thought supported the position about the race myth, and why was it a myth. And what did the Catholic conscience require? But I thought anybody who had a deep Catholic commitment might be able to write that article. It wasn't particularly sociological in that sense. And I found that happening. Now, the perhaps the most important happening in the very first fall that we were at Notre Dame occurred when Life magazine published an article in November of 1959. I have to look up the date to be sure it was November. It was called The Population Explosion. Now, it was important because it was written by some of the most distinguished demographers, and what they were pointing to, of course, in a way, it was in part the baby boom experience in the U.S., which was creating something of a population boom from the period of the Depression, when the fertility rates were down around 2.5, and suddenly they're jumping up above 3 and head towards 4. And then they looked at it worldwide, and they saw the same phenomenon occurring worldwide, and the implications of this explosion. Of course, worldwide, some of the growth was simply the impact of good sanitation in developing countries, which reduces death rates so dramatically. That leaves you with a rapid population growth. So, but what drew my attention to it was that the American Catholic bishops poo-pooed it, called it guesstimates, and made very negative comments towards the demographers. And the more I read it, the more I thought, well, it made a lot of sense. It looks like, you know, they really have some data here. So everything probably would have passed, except that Father Payne of Little Flower must have thought that he had to support the bishop, so he gave a Sunday sermon about the population guesstimate and sort of took the bishop's position, not vehemently, but was very strongly for the bishops, and that we should beware of these charges and what they implied about birth control or whatever. And at that time, Frank Fahey, did you know Frank?
Yes.
Frank and I shared an office, and we both went to Little Flower, and on Monday we were talking about it. I said, you know, Father Payne seems like a decent guy, but I have really, I don't want to keep going to church and hearing these sermons against social sciences when, in fact, you know, I think they're wrong. And we talked about what was wrong with the sermon and with the guest of it business, and could we, you know, we prepare a statement. So we prepared a statement, which was not a blast at the bishops, but showing that the, it was time to take sociology more into account here, and demographers into account. And then we called up Father Payne and said we'd like to come and talk to him. Well, if you know him, you know, he was a very personable,
yeah,
saintly guy. And so he said, sure. So we went over and met with him in his office and presented him with the statement of what we thought was wrong with his sermon. And he said, well, you know, I didn't know. I don't know anything about the social sciences, and I'm glad I have you two guys here, and so I'm going to apologize. No, we said, you don't have to apologize. Well, he said, I ought to say something clarifying it. I don't want people to think I'm stupid, and I thought it was, you know, I'm going to be more careful about this. So whatever he did eventually, he would consult us whenever there was an issue like this. And so this was, again, a step between sociology and religion, where my being a sociologist affected the way I saw things happening around me. Then, just skipping briefly to what became the next major event at Notre Dame, while I'm still doing my border research. My focus was on getting out a book on the influentials in two border cities, which was the eventual name of the book. It'd be El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And as I thought back about this and about this conversation we were going to have, I realized I did interview the bishop of El Paso, and I remember his name was Metzger, German or descended bishop, but he turned out not to be an influential in El Paso. And my interest was in who was influencing border relationships. And so, even though I had that interview, it never led anywhere because I don't think I have a paragraph in our book or in my doctoral dissertation about religion on the border. It wasn't relevant to what I was doing. I was looking at business and political relations, and religion was not a part of them. I did make contact with the PAN party in Juarez, Partido Acción Nacional, the National Action Party, and it turned out that many of their leaders in Juarez were members of Catholic Action. But again, it didn't seem particularly relevant to me, as the Catholic part didn't seem as relevant as did the political part where they were running against the government. So, 1963, I'm in the midst of finishing this book, and this John the 23rd has called this consul, this Vatican II consul, and my friend Milton Rokic at Michigan State is writing me letters saying, oh, another disaster for the church. Don't you guys know well enough to leave bad enough alone? You had Vatican Council I, look what it did. And I'm trying to be optimistic and say, oh, no, this is going to be different. This pope is different without any good background knowledge. I think Milt Rokic knew more about Vatican I than I did. But I sort of had this great faith in John the 23rd, he talked about opening windows, and so I wasn't looking at this as a sociologist either. I was looking at this as a way of opening the church, and that there were things festering, but which we all sort of swept under our rugs, thinking, well, we have a good parish, and let's be happy. So I invited Rokic to come down to Notre Dame, because he said, how could you survive there? And he came down and gave a lecture, played handball, and we played a lot of handball together in those days, and came down the next year and gave a lecture, and was by this time it was quite clear John the 23rd was different, as became evident from the very first session. Well, at that very time, one of the things that John the 23rd did that got little attention was that he created this small committee of five to look at the birth control question, sort of separating it out from the major discussions that were going on at the Vatican II. And one of the five was somebody I knew, Tom Birch, who was a member of this new young coterie of sociologists and demographers, and he was on the commission. But that occurred at a time when, who was George Shuster, our special assistant to the president, had been president of Hunter College, got a couple of large grants from Ford and or Rockefeller, I can't remember which, or both, and decided that we should have a Catholic Commission on Responsible Parenthood. That was the title, Responsible Parenthood. And we should begin discussions with bringing in people from all over the country. And the first session was going to be on Costi Canubi. Was it an infallible document? Can you believe this is 1963?
Yeah.
Was it an infallible document? And I was invited to be on the Notre Dame Commission with Bill Liu,
yes,
and Don Barrett. And I don't know if anybody else, we were the three members of the department that I recall. Richard McCormick as a theologian. There were two other theologians whom I don't recall. Pat and Patty Crowley. And this theologian from Europe named Bernard Herring.
Herring.
Well, the first session was so dramatic. Father Sheedy was on the commission. And he admitted that he had never thought about Costi Canubi. I had read it, but I didn't, I don't know if I thought it was infallible, but the infallibility kind of fell apart by the end of the fall of 1963. I think there was a vote. The first vote was like among the theologians, 3-2, that it was infallible. But then as the months progressed, it moved the other way. And as it moved the other way, more and more people were brought in. We were meeting 2 and 3 times a year. There was a Father Imbiorski from Chicago, whose name I remember, and George Shuster had the money. We even brought in demographers from the secular world to talk about responsible parenthood. And there were Ray Potvin was, yeah, I found his name. I have the document here that we signed in 1965. By 65, we had a growing consensus among what was now 35 people, I think, including John Noonan. I remember I actually have a copy of the document that we sent to Rome via Father Hesburgh to the Pope on our findings, which were that the Church's teachings could be changed. In fact, we were so convinced of it that by this time there was a Notre Dame group from the commission that going out traveling around the country, and I was on that commission. The head of, one of the interesting features of this was that there was Dr. Carney, I have a letter from him, he was vice president of G.D. Searle, which was the company that was producing the pill. And he was describing his research on the pill and trying to convince Rome that this pill was a valid means of birth regulation, or a regulation of female cycles was the idea behind the pill. And it did regulate cycles, but it also prevented conception. So he was, he eventually became the president of the Notre Dame Alumni Association.
Oh, wow.
Oh yeah, but they know this is, Hesburgh was very open to this. If you, well, I don't know if he ever wrote personally what he thought, but he certainly was pretty open. So I, in the spring, remember, I'm still thinking of myself as a Catholic who is a sociologist. I'm not doing sociology of religion. But in the spring of 64, the committee or commission thought that it would be appropriate to make a first public statement. And Philip Sharper was on this commission also, the editor of Harper Magazine or something, or one of the big book companies. And he said, no, let Bill D'Antonio do it. So I did it. And in the spring of 64, I gave a public lecture at the law school auditorium. That's how Lorraine joked about saying three rosaries that night. Now, I avoided saying that, it was by contemporary standards. It was cautious, but it was showing that the evidence about the church's position was faulty. Costi Canubi was based on the Onan story, which was by this time 20, 30 years after the Costi Canubi had been written. Almost all major scholars said that the sin of Onan was that he broke the law of Leveret and was unkind to Tamar, the woman, or whatever. Probably Tamar killed him, not God, for out of frustration. So, there is a pretty solid theology about that story now. And so it was, grounded poorly, and then when Bernard Herring came through with his studies, and there was this guy Davis from England, who was another theologian, who showed, as far as intentionality went, a whole bunch of other studies, including, I think, by this time, the Crowleys had done a survey of the members of Christian Family Movement on whether or not the rhythm method was a viable and welcome and effective method. Well, because one of the psychiatrists on the commission was a psychiatrist from Catholic U, a conservative, who kept saying that, when we get the data on people using rhythm, we'll show that we have the perfect method. Well, of course, the data was like 85 or 90% of people using rhythm were frustrated, upset, angry. Marriage was threatened by this. I mean, the data were so overwhelming that when it was presented at the Vatican meeting, we see about half of the people on the Notre Dame group were also members of the Vatican Commission, appointed eventually by Paul VI after John the 23rd died. It was only five or six members when John the 23rd constructed, but after his death in 63, Paul VI raised the number first to 25 and then to 50 and eventually to 55. By then it included bishops and archbishops, but I don't think any cardinals, but it was now worldwide. And Tom Birch, who had been on from the very beginning, was still on it. So that was a very important period of time in which I'm moving more and more into becoming involved in religious matters of the church rather than just a personal action, as the statement on the Christian conscience was. And I found myself, without realizing it, becoming more and more concerned about church teachings and how they impacted people. In fact, I have an article that I wrote at the close of Vatican II. It's called In the Wake of Vatican II, using the word wake in double meanings. Right. And interestingly, I have a copy of the article, so you want to see it sometime. I predicted, maybe you don't have to be, I think you don't have to be a genius. I predicted that what was going to happen was that to the degree to which the bishops were willing to listen to the laity, there would be a combination and a new inspired, vigorous church. To the degree to which the bishops and the hierarchy in the Vatican continued to issue edicts about you must do this and you have to do that, the laity were going to reason for themselves and make their own decisions. That was 1966. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as it turns out, pretty close. Now, right about that time, and I'm not clear on this, I'll be thinking about it. There was a priest who headed the Catholic Extension Society out of Chicago named Sullivan.
Yeah.
A nice, friendly guy who had been coming to some of our sessions and knew me, and he called me up, or he came to visit. He said, Bishop Reed, Victor Reed of Oklahoma, wonders if you could do a study of what Catholics really believe. You know, what are the church teachings on this and this and this, and what do they really believe? He says he wants to know the difference. He doesn't want to just wish they believe something. He wants to know if they really do. Could you do it? Well, this is the first time I was actually asked to do a study that I would call a sociological study. So I said, well, yeah, I think so. I have to figure out you know, how much money it would cost and if I could get some students to go to Oklahoma because I'm working on something else. So it happened that Jim Davidson was completing his first year in graduate studies for his PhD, and another guy named Joe Schlagen, who he and Jim had become close buddies. And so I called him in. It was probably March or something. And I said, what are you guys doing during the summer? Are you going to be around here? Well, yeah, I haven't got anything scheduled yet. I was thinking about it. I said, well, would you like to go to Oklahoma? I kind of had a sketchy idea. I said, we're going to go to a couple of towns, and what would make the study interesting is we're going to try to compare what Catholics believe with what Protestants believe. Well, to make a long story short, they said yes, they would be available, and the Catholic Extension Society, or Bishop Reed, or both, I don't know if I ever really remember how that happened, came up with, I think, $10,000 for that year and another $10,000 for the next year. And I sent Jim to Poto, or Edmond. He went to Edmond, Oklahoma, which had a tornado recently. And Joe went to Poto. I mean, little towns. But there were, we picked these out because there was at least one Catholic parish at each one. An Evangelical Assembly of God, an Episcopal, and a Lutheran, something like that. There were five or six churches. Mm-hmm. And we went through the business of constructing an instrument that would attempt to get at what people said they believed, horizontal beliefs and vertical beliefs mm-hmm. about God, Christian, and particularly Catholic, and how one lived these beliefs in terms of what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself. And we actually got three articles out of this, including one in Social Forces, which is one of the top three journals in sociology. And we got the other two in the Sociology of Religion journal. So that was my first venture, and I think we made a first presentation. Jim seems to recall that it was in 66 in Chicago at one of the meetings, maybe, of the Society for the Study of Religion. And I remember Andy Greeley was the host of that group there. So that got me into the sociology of religion. Now, about the same time, I guess, now see, my memory slips back and forth here. In 64, right after the big 63 meeting on the responsible parenthood. George Shuster got me, or suggested that he could get some money if we could have a major conference on religion in Latin America, because Bishop Mark McGrath was also, yeah. And at this time, too, I'm into Selam. I mean, all of these things are happening, and my mind is just slowly recording them. I'm not quite sure when I joined Selam, but I think it must have been around the same time, because that's when Shuster says, do you want to do something about Latin America? And he knew I had done my doctoral dissertation on Mexico. When I, in 64, the book came out on Influentials in Two Border Cities. Bill Form was the co-author with me of that book. And that was, but it didn't have anything to do about religion.
Take a time out and come in.
Yeah.
Okay, we will take a time out and we'll do part 3.